Good evening. I'm Jeff Bennett.
And I'm Amna Nawaz. On the NewsHour tonight, Israeli forces battle Hamas in a refugee camp in Gaza as hostage negotiations continue.
Congress struggles to contain the federal debt and deficit as another potential government shutdown looms.
And a program in Thailand looks to counteract the increasing trend of grandparents raising grandchildren as farming becomes a less reliable source of income.
What climate change is doing is exacerbating impacts on other more traditional economic and political drivers of migration.
Welcome to the NewsHour, a day of waiting, watching, and worry for the families of hostages held by Hamas in Gaza.
Weeks of negotiations have led to an agonizing day as talks continue to free some of the nearly 240 hostages. Under a proposed deal, Hamas would reportedly exchange 50 women and children they hold for 150 women and children in Israeli detention. Nick Schifrin has the latest.
In Tel Aviv today, the families of Israeli hostages united in prayer. They don't know if their loved ones are alive, but they hold on to new hope they might come home soon.
I think the only thing that I could call justice is bringing everyone back home.
After more than a month of negotiations between Israel, Hamas, and the U.S., mediated by Qatar, every side indicated today a deal was closer than ever.
We're now very close. We could bring some of these hostages home very soon. But I don't want to get into the details of things because nothing is done until it's done.
Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu.
The return of the hostages, we are making progress. I don't think it's worth saying too much, not at even this moment, but I hope there will be good news soon.
Hamas political official Khalil Al-Khaya.
We believe that we are in decisive moments in this matter, and we all hope, God willing, that this truce will be the cessation of aggression for days and the entry of relief for our people.
Israeli and U.S. officials tell PBS NewsHour Hamas would release 50 women and children, and Israel would release 150 women and children currently detained in Israeli prisons, hold fire for 4 to 5 days, increase humanitarian assistance into Gaza, and restrict drone surveillance flights over Gaza. But the war goes on. Today, Israel attacked the Jabalia refugee camp in northern Gaza. It's a tightly packed area full of Palestinian families who fled from present-day Israel when Israel gained independence. Today, it's a moonscape. The IDF says they've killed dozens of Hamas militants who fled to Jabalia from Gaza City. IDF spokesman Admiral Daniel Hagari.
We completed the encirclement of Jabalia, which is a significant combat zone. We have the upper hand in every battle. We will continue to eliminate Hamas terrorists wherever they are.
Including Hamas's infrastructure in hospitals. At the Al-Aqsa Hospital in central Gaza, Israeli drones are constant. And the neonatal intensive care unit is full of babies fighting to survive.
Their lives are endangered because we have a shortage of fuel, we have a shortage of electricity.
Dr. Ashleen says the fuel that powers the incubators that keeps them alive is running low. She says this 2-week-old baby girl was left an orphan and in critical condition with a brain injury after her family was killed in an airstrike.
She's in very critical condition. Hopefully, we'll try hardly to keep her alive. But if she's kept alive, so who to care with her? She lost the parents.
5,000 miles away, Chinese Communist Party General Secretary Xi Jinping spoke to a virtual gathering of the BRICS, Brazil, Russia, India, China, and South Africa, about the war and a path to peace. Xi called for a 2-state solution.
There can be no sustainable peace and security in the Middle East without a just solution to the question of Palestine.
Russian President Vladimir Putin blamed the war on the U.S. and said the BRICS should be negotiating.
The loss of thousands of lives, the mass expulsion of civilians, and the resulting humanitarian catastrophe are of grave concern. All these events are a direct consequence of the United States' desire to monopolize the mediations.
As for the hostages, there is no monopoly on these negotiations. To be sure, only risks. And at this hour, Amna, with no word from the White House, Jerusalem, or Doha, our wait continues.
Painful wait for so many. But Nick, walk us through what we know about a potential deal here. How would it work?
So part of the negotiation that has been happening is for safe passage for these hostages to go from Hamas control into Israel. And in the past, a kind of pilot was done by the U.S., Israel, Hamas, Egypt, and Qatar that released two Americans. And that pilot allowed the ICRC to bring those two hostages from Hamas into Israel and hand them over to Israeli troops. The idea this time is that they would be handed over to Israeli troops and from there go to about half a dozen hospitals that Israel has already been identified. Many of them will need medical attention. The National Security Council staff today said they've been held in abhorrent conditions. Some, of course, have pre-existing conditions that will need to be addressed. And then, depending on the nationalities, they would go, of course, and be repatriated. In total, we believe that as many as about 30 children and 60 women are being held by Hamas. This deal only allows for 50 of them to be released. We're not sure which 50. We're also not sure of which of the 10 Americans will be released, but we know that there are three Americans in this category, beginning with a three-year-old. Three-year-old Abigail Mor Idan, you see her there. Her parents were both killed on the morning of October 7th. And there are two American women being held. Liat Benin Adzili was a tour guide at Israel's Holocaust Museum, Yad Vashem. And Judah Haggai was kidnapped from the kibbutz Nir Oz in southern Gaza. That's her right there. But again, we do not have the confirmation of who exactly will be released.
Nick, any hostage negotiation is fraught and high stakes. Why has this one been so particularly difficult?
The first reason is shuttle diplomacy. Of course, Israel is not talking to Hamas. The United States is not talking to Hamas. And so in the middle are Qatar and Egypt, and they have been the one passing messages to and from all the sides. And Hamas, I'm told, is not always reliable. It is a terrorist organization, after all. Secondly, it's not only Hamas. Palestinian Islamic Jihad have been holding hostages, and some Israeli officials believe even civilians are holding some of these hostages separate from Hamas. And thirdly, on the other side, there's been Israeli resistance. Tonight, Benjamin Netanyahu is meeting with his government, the coalition. There has been resistance from especially the far-right parties in that coalition to hold ceasefire at all as part of this deal, let alone any kind of reduction in surveillance flights that might have to happen as well. But the bottom line, Netanyahu made clear tonight that a ceasefire will not be the end of this war. He actually called that, quote, nonsense. Instead, he said, we will continue the war until we achieve all of our war aims after the hostages are released.
Nick Schifrin reporting on the latest on this imminent, hopefully, hostage deal.
Hopefully.
Nick, thank you.
Thanks, Emma.
Now to the families of people held by Hamas and this agonizing 6 weeks of horror and worry. Five of Abby On's family members were kidnapped on October 7th. Her grandmother, Carmela Dan, an American-Israeli dual national, and her 13-year-old niece, Noya, were found dead just inside Gaza 1 month ago. Carmela's son-in-law, Ofer, and his two other children, 16-year-old Sahar and 12-year-old Erez, are still held hostage. Liz Hirsch-Naftali is awaiting the return of the youngest American hostage, her grandniece, three-year-old Abigail Mor Idan. Abby and Liz, welcome to you both, and thank you for joining us. I just want to begin by asking both of you to share what this moment is like, knowing that a deal to release some of the hostages, at least, could be imminent. Liz, why don't you begin?
Well, first, thank you for having us on the show. I think it's important for us to just keep talking about the hostages and reminding people that these are innocent civilians that were taken hostage, were abducted on October 7th. And my grandniece, Abigail, is 3 years old. And I am thankful for all the work that President Biden, the administration, has been leading. I'm thankful to whatever support the Qatar government is and everybody that's involved. But what I feel tonight is like we started this morning with this excitement that we were going to have a hostage deal, and it's now the evening and we don't necessarily have a hostage deal. And what it is a reminder of is that until we see Abigail and other children and mothers leaving Gaza, we cannot let go. We cannot stop doing this work, and we can't believe it until we actually see it.
Abby, what about you? You've already lost family members. We are so sorry for that loss you've already suffered. But this hope that the remaining family members could be released, what's this moment like?
I think Liz says it well, but it's almost like a knot. Like you're waiting for something to untie, but it's not there yet. It feels really fragile. There's so many things that have to come into place at the right time. And then there's the kind of, I think it's 30 hours where people can appeal. And that the notion that any sort of military mishap could put this in danger as well. And so we have a lot of hope, I think more hope than we've had at any other point in the process in terms of a diplomatic resolution for the 50. But we still feel like until we can see them with our eyes, until we can touch them, the knot is still in our stomachs.
And Abby, do you know, have you gotten any indication that this would mean at least the two youngest, Sahara and Erez in this case, would be released as part of a potential deal?
There's no confirmation of names right now. As far as I understand it, the government will be getting a list of 10 names the night before each release, if this is to move forward. I hope that they would then share the names with the families, because as I understand, the first thing that's going to happen is medical care and then right to the families. And so I think the families will need some sort of preparation. But there is speculation that they would be among the children released.
Liz, of course, that would mean the release of 3-year-old Abigail, the youngest American there. And you're wearing that 45 on your shirt to remind everyone just how long she and the others have been held. But I need to ask you as well about some of the opposition in the Israeli government. There are some who say a deal is not a good idea. You shouldn't be negotiating with terrorists. A ceasefire could just allow time for Hamas to regroup. What do you make of that argument?
I make of it no argument. We need to have these children come home. These are 30-plus innocent civilians who are children. This is not political. This is humanitarian. They have been abducted. They are somewhere in the dark in Gaza for over 45 days now. Enough is enough. They need to come home. This is not about politics. This is about children that should not be in the middle of a war, that did nothing. Abigail is 3 years old. Her birthday is on Friday. No child should spend their birthday as a hostage. None of these children should be there. So I pivot and I don't go to the politics. And I just remind everybody that is listening, and I hope our leaders who are listening, we need to bring these children home, and we need to bring them home now.
Liz, I should ask you too. I know her two older siblings survived. They were rescued by IDF forces. How are they doing? What do you tell them about what's going on?
These children watched both their parents be murdered by Hamas terrorists on October 7th. They then went and they buried their parents. They are blessed to be with loving family, cousins, aunts, uncles, grandparents. But these children, they know what is going on. They are very articulate about what happened, and the family is very honest about what is going on. And really, their hope, the one thing that they are holding hope and faith, is that Abigail is going to come home to them really soon and run around and play soccer, eat ice cream, and do what three little kids do, siblings do. And so the thought of a 6 and 10-year-old having witnessed that as a mother, I can't bear it. But I also know that the one thing that they are waiting for right now is their little sister to come home so that they can hug her and celebrate her 4th birthday with her.
Abby, Erez is just 12, I understand, and Sahar is just 16. And I know there's a lot of uncertainty throughout the last 6 weeks, but there is video that you've seen. You see Erez. He was alive when he was taken. You can only imagine what's going through his mind when he's in the hands of those terrorists there. But what can you tell us about this 12-year-old boy, about his 16-year-old sister?
As we said, no one should celebrate their birthday in captivity, and Erez turned 12 there in October. So we deeply believe that it's the job of the Israeli government and all of our governments to bring them home. Erez is now the same age as my son. He is a horseback rider, and he's a bike rider. He plays the trumpet, and he loves Legos. He is the baby of 4 siblings. Sahar is 16. She has another year left of high school. She and her older sister are best friends. They, if you don't look closely, you would mistake them for one another. They're both beautiful and look like twins. She's an artist. She plays the bass, and they need to be brought home to their siblings and to their mother.
If there is a deal, I should ask you both, it will likely mean some, not all, the hostages come home. And I know there is this bond now between you and all the other families enduring the unimaginable right now. I just want to ask each of you what that conversation is like between you and the other families, knowing some of you will be able to see your loved ones soon, but not everyone. Liz?
It is a cruel and terrible conversation. But I will say that I really believe that everybody understands that the children need to come out first. The little kids need to come out first. I know that once Abigail comes out, I and other parents and relatives of these hostages will continue to work every day to ensure that all 230 plus hostages come home to their families. So I pray that we get these kids out and that we then continue, and we will, and these families are together in this process. And it's just, I'd like everybody to come out, and they will. We just have to do this in a way that actually takes care of our little children first.
Abby, what would you say to that?
Look, we've seen four people be released already and one person be rescued, and every single one of them was a success and a celebration, and we rejoiced. And I think at this point, we all are close with one another, and it weighs heavy on our hearts to think that some will come out and others won't. In my situation, God willing, Erez and Sahar come out, but Ofer won't, right? He is a grown man, so he would not be among this list. And so, as Liz is saying, whoever comes out, it doesn't stop the fight for any of us. We will fight until every single hostage is home. And I think we'll all have more motivation knowing that there was a diplomatic resolution, that something can be solved, and that we can fight to bring every single one of them home.
That is Abby Ohn and Liz Hirsch Naftali. We are thinking of you and of your families, and we thank you so much for joining us tonight. Thank you both.
Thank you.
Thank you for having us.
In the day's other headlines, the world's largest cryptocurrency exchange, Binance, pleaded guilty in a sweeping U.S. securities investigation and agreed to pay $4.3 billion in fines. The charges were similar to those against FTX, the crypto company that collapsed last year. Attorney General Merrick Garland said Binance let drug gangs and terror groups launder money.
Using new technology to break the law does not make you a disruptor. It makes you a criminal. This Justice Department has no tolerance for crimes that threaten our economic institutions and undermine public trust in the fairness of those institutions.
Also today, the founder of Binance, Changpeng Zhao, pleaded guilty to failing to prevent money laundering. He said he is stepping down as CEO. North Korea claims it launched a spy satellite into orbit today on its third try. There was no independent confirmation, but the U.S., Japan, and South Korea condemned the attempt, which violated a U.N. ban. The North said its leader, Kim Jong-un, watched the launch and said the satellite is a response to hostile military moves by the U.S. and Japan. The Philippines and the U.S. have started joint naval and air patrols in waters near Taiwan in a move to counter China. Beijing has claimed much of the South China Sea inside the so-called Nine Dash Line. The Philippines and other regional countries dispute that boundary. Just last month, a Chinese Coast Guard ship rammed a Filipino vessel in the South China Sea. Top European officials made new shows of support for Ukraine today in its war with Russia. Germany's defense minister Boris Pistorius laid flowers at the Maidan Uprising Memorial in Kyiv. It marks pro-Western protests that toppled a pro-Russian president 10 years ago. And European Union President Charles Michel met with Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky. In a recorded message, Zelensky warned against accepting a stalemate with Moscow.
When the civilized world starts looking for compromises with terrorists and making concessions to tyrants, then we will all lose. Ukraine, Europe, the world. We lose naively thinking that there can be a draw with them. A draw is impossible.
In Washington, the White House warned there are signs that Iran may provide ballistic missiles to Russia. And the UN Human Rights Office reported more than 10,000 civilians have died in Ukraine in nearly 2 years of war. Back in this country, there's word that House Speaker Mike Johnson met with former President Donald Trump last night in Florida. It's widely reported that Johnson traveled to the Trump estate at Mar-a-Lago a week after endorsing Mr. Trump's presidential bid. The new speaker is already taking fire from hard-right Republicans for relying on Democrats to pass a government funding bill. Millions of people began boarding flights and hitting the highways today for what may be a record Thanksgiving travel season. Airports anticipated more than 5 million passengers before Thursday, and AAA predicted 55 million Americans will drive at least 50 miles from home. In the east, travelers face a storm moving up the Atlantic coast that could disrupt both air and ground traffic. In economic news, sales of existing homes in October were the slowest in 13 years as high mortgage rates and high prices took a toll. And on Wall Street, stocks came up short. The Dow Jones Industrial Average lost 62 points to close at 35,088. The Nasdaq fell 84 points. The S&P 500 slipped 9. Still to come on the NewsHour, 14th Amendment cases challenge Donald Trump's eligibility for the 2024 election. Earthquakes rattle southwestern Iceland as a volcanic eruption may be just days away, plus much more.
This is the PBS NewsHour from WETA Studios in Washington and in the West from the Walter Cronkite School of Journalism at Arizona State University.
The U.S. government remains open this Thanksgiving week thanks to a temporary funding deal Congress passed last week. But that deal starts to expire in January, and conservatives are signaling they won't pass another funding deal without addressing a bigger issue, the swelling U.S. national debt. This, as what the U.S. pays in interest cost, is soaring. Jeff is with our Lisa Desjardins to make sense of the trillions involved.
Amna, thank you. Lisa, it's good to see you.
Great to see you.
So we know the top line number, the total national debt, is almost $34 trillion. But economists have noticed that something is changing, right? So what is it?
It's the cost of the debt. And if you look at the markets, you know why. To fight inflation, the Federal Reserve has been increasing interest rates. Well, that means what the U.S. is paying for its loans is also going up. I wanted this to be very understandable, so I want to look at interest costs, what we pay on our national debt, per day. Now, I've calculated these numbers thanks to some help from the Joint Economic Committee and Dave Schweikert's office. $1 billion, that's how much we were paying in interest 2 years ago. Let's watch the curve. Here we go after the pandemic. Interest rates go up a little bit, $1.4 billion a day. Look at the last 6 months. As we see interest rates go up, look at what the U.S. is paying. More than twice in interest costs per day that we did 2 years ago. Now, $2.6 billion, what is that? Think about this. In a week, what we're paying on interest is enough for everything President Biden has requested for border security for a year.
Wow. So what about the total number?
Right. Okay. Another big number. What does this mean overall? Right now, the U.S. in a year, between November to October in the past year, spent $749 billion on interest. What does that number mean? Department of Defense budget. How much we've spent on that in fiscal 23? $782 billion. So right now, just the interest on our debt is so large that it is almost the entire Department of Defense budget.
And Lisa, we hear lawmakers talk all the time about the debt and deficit. How much does that debate on the Hill actually get at the core of the problem here?
So excited to get into this because, of course, Congress, as you know, we've covered it together. Congress only controls part of the budget, agencies by and large. But let's look at what the three largest drivers of the debt are in reality. These three things, Social Security there in yellow at the bottom, Medicare in blue, and interest, those costs right there. This is the percentage of the budget these things make up now. In 2033, all three of those things are going to grow. Look at that. Social Security, especially Medicare, growing. These are mandatory costs that Congress isn't even talking about when we talk about a government shutdown or discretionary funding. The green, that is what Congress controls. That money is expected to go down. So really what's happening here is Congress is not addressing the big drivers of the debt at all. And when you talk to economists like Mark Zandi of Moody's Analytics, he says Congress needs to pay attention to and they need to stress the real stakes in all of this.
The lawmakers need to be able to connect in the minds of the voter that if we don't make changes, if we don't do things that are tough, like raise taxes or restrain spending, then interest rates are going to rise, and therefore we're not going to be able to, many Americans, most Americans won't be able to afford to buy a home and become a homeowner or even buy a vehicle. So, I think it's going to take some pressure, some economic pressure for lawmakers to really come to terms. But so far, they haven't done that.
So, Lisa, what are lawmakers proposing as potential solutions here?
We went back and listened to the last couple of weeks of debate about fiscal policy, about a potential government shutdown that we just avoided this time around. And first, I want to note that there are more members of Congress talking about this issue. So let's listen, first of all, of what they had to say.
The greatest threat to our national security is our nation's debt.
We've been spending more than we bring in our government every year for the past 21 years.
As a nation, we must be concerned about the growth in the national debt.
When is it going to be enough? Is $34 trillion of debt not enough? $2 trillion deficits not enough?
If you don't like math and don't want to deal with reality, please stop watching.
Keep watching, because math is important, reality is important. And the reality is, though, as much as these members have lots of graphs, they're pointing out the problem, there really are not yet specific plans to deal with this. It comes down to two things, Jeff, you know well. Either you have to cut spending, cut benefits, or you have to increase revenue. Most every smart economist says you've got to do some combination of both, but it's become a partisan debate. There is a potential commission on the horizon. Speaker Johnson mentioned that in his first speech. He wants a commission. My reporting is, however, that is stuck at the moment because they can't agree on what kind of teeth a fiscal commission could have. It's fine to propose recommendations, but if the Senate doesn't really have to take a vote, what does it matter? Until they can agree on that, even a commission itself is in gridlock, even as our debt continues to get more and more at the moment.
Lisa Desjardins, thanks so much for this great reporting and analysis.
You're welcome.
A Civil War-era clause in the Constitution is at the center of a major legal question for 2024. Is former President Donald Trump qualified to be on the ballot? White House correspondent Laura Barrón-López takes a deeper look at the lawsuits over the 14th Amendment.
The legal war continues over whether former President Trump should be disqualified from the ballot in Colorado. The case is over Section 3 of the 14th Amendment, which bars a person from future office if they have taken an oath to the Constitution and later engage in an insurrection or aid the Constitution's enemies. On Friday, a Colorado district judge ruled that Trump did engage in an insurrection by inciting the January 6th attack on the U.S. Capitol, but said the little-known clause doesn't apply to the presidency. Now, both Trump and the plaintiffs in the case, backed by the nonprofit Citizens for Responsibility and Ethics in Washington, have filed appeals. Joining me now to discuss is Lawrence Tribe. He's a constitutional scholar at Harvard Law School and first backed the 14th Amendment theory earlier this year. Professor Tribe, thank you so much for joining the NewsHour. The judge ruled that Trump engaged in an insurrection, a notable ruling, but that for the purposes of the 14th Amendment, the president is not, quote, an officer of the United States. To the average person, that might be pretty confusing, that every other public official, senator, congress member, qualifies under this, but the president doesn't. Can you explain that?
Well, it's quite confusing. And in fact, it was confusing to the trial court judge herself. She conducted a very elaborate week-long trial. There was a great deal of evidence on the basis of which she carefully found, by clear and convincing evidence, that Donald Trump, not only on January 6th, but in the lead-up to January 6th, having taken an oath to support the Constitution, turned against it and engaged in an insurrection against it. But amazingly, she said, the language of the 14th Amendment, which was designed to protect the country and protect democracy from insurrectionists who had taken an oath to the Constitution, exempts the president. She said that that may sound preposterous, and it does, because it is. The language clearly covers the presidency as an office under the Constitution. It's described that way throughout the Constitution. Donald Trump himself described it that way in his filings in other cases. And in fact, exempting the presidency would turn the Constitution upside down. Mm-hmm. It would mean, among other things, that Jefferson Davis, having led the Confederacy, could then have turned around after the Civil War and been president again. That's not the way the Constitution was designed or written.
There's a few other things I want to get to, but this is being appealed to the Colorado Supreme Court now. So what do you expect to happen next?
Right. Well, I think the Colorado Supreme Court, which is on a very expedited schedule, is quite likely to reverse the bizarre holding that exempts the president, a holding that would, among other things, mean that presidents could accept emoluments from foreign countries, that you could have a religious test for the presidency. Having done that, the question is, will they find some basis to overturn the really important holding of the trial court that this was an insurrection against the Constitution and that Donald Trump engaged in it? If they don't overturn that holding, they will order that Trump not be on the ballot, and he will then seek review in the U.S. Supreme Court, which will undoubtedly agree to hear the case on an expedited basis because the primary election is going to occur really quite soon in early 2024 in Colorado.
Professor Michael Mukasey, the former attorney general under George W. Bush, argued in an op-ed recently that Trump is not an, quote, officer of the United States, which is some of the language that they use in the 14th Amendment. And he cited a 2010 ruling by the Supreme Court where Chief Justice John Roberts said that the people do not vote for officers of the United States. So what's your response to that argument?
It's completely wrong. Judge Luttig, Michael Luttig, a very distinguished former federal judge, a conservative, and I have examined that argument and find it, frankly, empty. It just doesn't make sense. Of course, the people don't vote for other officers. That's why the Constitution specifies that the senators and members of the House are subject to this. And then it says, so are officers of the United States, those who are not elected. It's true that presidents aren't elected, neither are cabinet members, yet no one doubts that they are subject to this restriction. It just doesn't make the slightest sense. And with all due respect to former Attorney General Mukasey, he wouldn't get a high grade on turning that answer in.
If these challenges to former President Trump's qualification fail, and if Trump is granted absolute immunity from criminal prosecution for conspiring to overturn the 2020 election, which is something that he's arguing in the federal January 6 case, what does that mean for the presidency and accountability?
Well, if that were to happen, and I very much hope it doesn't, it would turn the presidency into a dictatorship. It would basically mean that the revolution that we fought against King George failed, and that the American experiment in constitutional democracy, with no one being above the law, lasted 225 years and then ended. I don't want that to happen. I think it would be a disaster for the freedom of every one of us to have anybody completely above the law. We have, in this case, someone who said he would terminate the Constitution. He will make his presidency about vengeance. It's what fascists do. It's what is happening in many parts of the world. In Russia, quite recently, it looks like Argentina is moving in that direction. Mm-hmm. In Hungary, we really should not join those that have turned their backs on freedom and liberty. That's what would happen if absolute immunity were granted to the president and if he were allowed to take power again.
Professor Lawrence Tribe of Harvard Law School, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you so much.
The number of households where grandchildren are being raised by grandparents has been on the rise for decades in lower and middle-income countries. Parents have moved abroad or into urban areas for job opportunities and higher wages, in part because agricultural jobs no longer provide a reliable income due to climate change. Special correspondent Fred DeSam-Lazaro looks at one program in rural Thailand aimed at keeping families together by providing alternative sources of income. It's part of Fred's series, Agents for Change.
Look.
In millions of households across rural Thailand, this is what the dinner hour looks like. Grandma and grandpa feeding the little ones. Mom and dad nowhere in the picture.
Every day, I fetch food for the two kids, and I take the children to and from school.
At 74, Pramai Lursubchat says he has little choice raising his grandchildren, 3 and 7, left in his care while his daughter works in the capital, Bangkok.
Hello.
Aside from a couple of visits a year, it's phone calls like this that keep the family connected.
The kids miss their mom. It's the way it is. Life is difficult. We have to survive. She left 2 years ago. There is no money, no jobs here.
And no way mom with a factory job could afford the daycare and high living costs of Bangkok to bring her children along. So Lursubchat and his second wife, Tongsri Pulatakang, also raising her daughter's newborn, make do on a combined pension of about $36 a month and an increasingly unproductive rice field they farm on rented land.
People in rural Thailand have for decades spent a few weeks each year away in the city, earning extra income in between planting and the harvest. But in recent times, agriculture, the rice crop in particular, has become unreliable as a source of income, and that's forced longer and longer absences from home.
What climate change is doing is exacerbating impacts on other, more traditional economic and political drivers of migration.
Sarah Vihil is a research fellow at the Stockholm Environment Institute at Chulalongkorn University in Bangkok.
Migration should be a choice. There are communities that would like to remain in place, that it's really a question of we lack the resources to diversify our incomes, which is becoming more and more difficult, of course, in the context of climate change. So family separation is one of the very violent kind of social impacts.
Women have been denied the basic human right of being a mother.
Michai Virabhaidya is on a mission to reunite families. We met him at the temple in Nan Suan, near Thailand's border with Cambodia, where a group of elderly residents were gathered.
How many of you have children that have left for the city whom you'd like to return home?
Michai, now 82, is a world-renowned social innovator, credited earlier with designing Thailand's successful family planning campaigns. An economist by training, he started the bamboo school nearby in 2009 to inspire rural youth in horticulture and entrepreneurship. Now he's trying to address the social impacts of internal migration in a country where some 3 million children are raised by family other than their parents.
We are finding out that more and more are willing to come home, especially if there's an alternative.
He started a pilot program called Homeward Bound that allows parents to return to their villages, provides them small loans and training to build and run a small business.
This will give very, very good profit. Mushroom chair, you pick it every day for 3 months. Just this much space will earn you 900,000 baht in a year.
Or $25,000, he says farmers would be financially secure on a lot less.
Most farmers are rice farmers, and the income from growing rice once a year is 5 baht per square meter, which is horrendous. So we need to diversify.
His school partners with nearby temples and hospitals where farmers' markets are held. Bamboo School students bring their training to teach new techniques on how to grow profitable crops in small spaces. Michai says the market is potentially huge. School lunches, for instance, could be supplied from small enterprises like the one started in the Nan Suan Temple, planting vegetables and selling snacks prepared here. There are some 40,000 1,000 temples across this predominantly Buddhist country.
We have 25 billion baht budget for school lunch. If the Ministry of Education is willing, they could use part of that money to buy vegetables from the elderly. So that will help, and that's part of the market system. You've got hospitals all over the place in Thailand. You've got schools, you've got temples, and we'll take a look at any other organization wants to work with us.
And tapping into that economic cycle would, he thinks, be enough to help more people like 39-year-old Sukanya Ninpayak, who returned in January from her city job as a baker's assistant. The Homeward Bound project allowed her and husband Prakai Tisanthier, himself laid off from a city job, to reunite with their daughters, 2 and 10, and her parents.
My family was so excited when I returned because visits before were infrequent.
They've set up a small farm at home, growing mushrooms and sunflower microgreens that she sells at a nearby hospital farmers market. At a workshop explaining the Homeward Bound program, there was no shortage of eager applicants, driven by the financial reality of their work situation and the pain of separation.
Last time I left, my kid ran after the car, but to stay was not an option either.
If I stayed, I would have no livelihood to sustain them.
I earn about $8.50 a day, but a plate of rice is $1.40, so there's little extra money.
Pramai Lur Subchat is urging his daughter to return to enroll in Michai's Homeward Bound program.
I have a contract. I have to wait.
His daughter, Samlit, says she feels out of place amid the bustle and bright lights of Bangkok, where she lives with her new husband, Suthi Sunkamrod. They are contract-bound for the next 2 years at their factory jobs. Leaving early would mean financial penalties.
I wish I could have raised my own children, but it hasn't been possible. I don't want to stay in Bangkok. I'm happiest when I can visit my children. My saddest memory is when I left my kids, but I didn't have any money to buy food.
For Michai Viravaidya, the next step is scaling up.
We can bring in the banking system of the government Bank of Agriculture and Cooperative. We need financial resources and business skills we can help with, and the other one is access to credit at a normal rate.
Affording parents enough money, he says, so they can stay close and parent. For the PBS NewsHour, I'm Fred DeSam-Lazaro in Bangkok.
And Fred's reporting is a partnership with the Undertold Stories Project at the University of St. Thomas in Minnesota.
Scientists in Iceland say a major volcanic eruption could occur within days, but they are increasingly optimistic that it may spare a town 40 miles southwest of the capital, Reykjavik. Special correspondent Malcolm Brabant has the story.
Listen to the roar of Mother Earth. That's the sound of magma, molten rock, bubbling away beneath the town of Grindavik, causing hundreds of earthquakes a day.
The outlook is rather bleak, in my opinion.
Geophysicist Ari Gudmundsson.
The ground in Grindavik is still subsiding, but you cannot really make a prognosis. How is eruption going to affect the town?
After being ordered to abandon Grindavik a week ago, its people have been allowed back to rescue key possessions. The owners of this craft store worked quickly to salvage stock, while other residents like Ingeborg Grettersdottir awaited their turn.
I'm not sure about the town, it looks awful. My house is okay, but it's on the red area. The earth has collapsed about 1 meter or something. So the lava, you know, is under our house. We don't know if we're gonna have a home or what.
It's hard to digest.
Pilot Einar Daubjartsson.
For the last 4 days, I've been just, when I wake up, after kind of bad sleep, you know, it's so worrying. Check the news, check the news. I've been expecting it to start But I am getting a little bit more hopeful that it's not going to erupt in the town.
If it happens, this eruption is not going to manifest itself in the classic way, from the top of a fiery mountain. Instead, scientists expect lava will burst through fissures in the ground, somewhere above a wide volcanic field. Kristin Jonsdottir is the head of Iceland's volcanoes department.
Every day what we're seeing is a decline in the rate of earthquakes and also in the rate of energy release from the earthquakes. However, this does not mean that an eruption is less likely. We've actually seen a similar decline just before the onset of eruptions in Fagradalsfjall.
Fagradalsfjall is the volcano that erupted in 2021 after being dormant for 800 years. That spectacular renaissance is being blamed for the current seismic activity, although the 1,200 feet high crater appears to be sleeping. With scientists monitoring the volcano, the priority of Prime Minister Katrin Jakobsdottir is the 4,000 displaced people.
We have put forward a bill to the parliament to ensure the salaries for the inhabitants of Grindavik, at least for the next 3 months. We are working to secure housing because 1,200 homes, people do not have guaranteed housing, so we are working on that.
Rikki Pedersen heads the Nordic Volcanological Centre at Iceland University.
What sort of scenarios do you envisage?
Currently, we have two main scenarios. One is that the current deformation that we see on the surface will slow down, decline, and eventually stop. But maybe a more likely scenario, as it's looking now, the pressure rises enough for it to actually open a vent at the surface and an eruption will start.
So when the molten rock, the magma, reaches the surface, it becomes lava and hot, does that mean that things are going to catch fire? Is the town going to burn to the ground?
Oh, of course, it really depends on where the fissure opens. So the most likely area is several kilometers north of Grindavík.
That scenario threatens the Blue Lagoon, a volcanic grotto and thermal spa beloved by tourists and currently closed. The Icelanders are also trying to protect one of five geothermal power stations that generate electricity from underground heat. Vidur Reynisson leads Iceland's civil defence units.
The barriers that we are building around the power plant is going quite well. We are a little bit ahead of schedule in that. So the first phases of the barriers are ready. So even if we would have an eruption in the dike at this moment, we would delay the lava flow to the power plant.
In 2010, another Icelandic volcano created an enormous ash cloud, causing the suspension of air travel in Europe and across the Atlantic.
How is this likely to compare to the eruption of Eyjafjallajökull? I think I pronounced it correctly.
Eyjafjallajökull is really not comparable to this at all. So when an eruption commenced there in 2010 in the top crater, it interacted very directly with the meltwater from the glacier and creating a very violent and explosive eruption. So very fine-grained ash that could be carried thousands of kilometers from the vent. This is not at all what we're going to see if we have an eruption on land.
The residents of Grindavik wonder whether they'll ever be able to return to what is for now a ghost town, where scientists are monitoring the seismic activity. Volcano Department spokesman Benedikt Offigson.
If an eruption will occur, it's probably within days rather than weeks.
Like this geyser, Icelanders are waiting to see whether the latest seismic activity is nothing but a damp squib. They're preparing for the worst, but hoping the volcano goes back to sleep in the land of the Northern Lights. For the PBS NewsHour, I'm Malcolm Brabant.
Jonathan McCrory has served as the artistic director at the National Black Theater for more than 10 years, and along the way earned three Obie Awards. That's the highest honor for off-Broadway theater. Tonight he shares his brief but spectacular take on love, joy, and the pursuit of happiness.
I am a creative doula.
A doula is a person who actually helps to birth the ideas, the child, the playwright, or the director are the mother and the father, and I'm helping them to birth that thing so that the world can see it and the world can be changed by it. My work at the National Black Theater is a 50-year-old organization. I've been there for about 11 years. We have been able to dream up and to believe into Dr. Barbara Antier's original vision, which was to create a space where people can live, serve, and work. And we use our theory of change as a way in which to make that happen, which is Black liberation plus art plus placemaking equals the conditions for humans to be transformed. If we imagine ourselves as butterflies, what is possible? If we imagine ourselves to be butterflies, what is possible? Who are we then if we imagine ourselves to be unfelled, unfettered, and unreleased from that husk? Imagining that maybe 3 years was a cocoon for us. 3 years was an imagination for us to be able to see, witness, and become something new. Who did you become? When I think about what it means to be full-bodied and fully present, I really have a conversation with how are we reckoning with some of the Western traditions that have actually allowed us to commodify ourselves instead of seeing ourselves as really powerful beings. Everything around us, everything that we're able to cultivate is of our own doing and is of our own becoming. You are the cultivation of wisdom wrapped in flesh. You are the cultivation of possibility made real. And every breath that you get to take, something is shifting inside this planet. Futures are being written that we have never even known. And those futures that are being written is what I need, is what our future need, is what our children need. I was crafted from that kind of technology. That my ancestors, ancestors of slaves, ancestors of people who were born into fortitude, also ancestors who were kings and queens, but those ancestors actually said, one day there would be a Jonathan, and I'm gonna show up for him in this moment. I'm gonna wrap my words with joy, and from that joy, allow for something magical to show up. That is what I'm asking for you to understand, that your presence right here is a gift. That's really what I mean about the power of presence, the ability to share love and to show love to any and everything, that you understand that there is only good in the world, and that through that good, you're radically transformed. And transformation doesn't mean that it's always comfortable. It means you live in the discomfort of your growth. Remember, that breath was a gift. The next one is a gift. Energy turned into manifesting something real. What realness will you do with the time you have, with the seconds that you're given? My name is Jonathan McCory, and this is my brief but spectacular take on love, joy, and the pursuit of happiness.
And later this evening on PBS, Frontline presents a film that takes an unfiltered look at the war in Ukraine. With reporting by Associated Press journalists, 20 Days in Mariupol offers a vivid, harrowing account of civilians caught in the siege, as well as a window into what it's like to report from a war zone.
Someone once told me, wars don't start with explosions. They start with silence.
Лично видим визуально. Танки зашли с надписью Z.
Город Мариуполь блокирован со всех сторон.
Russians have entered the city. The war has begun, and we have to tell its story.
Хорошо, что тут есть пресса. Снимайте.
This is painful to watch. But it must be painful to watch.
20 Days in Mariupol premieres tonight at 10 p.m. Eastern on PBS and is available to stream on YouTube and the PBS app.
And that is the NewsHour for tonight. I'm Jeff Bennett.
And I'm Amna Nawaz. On behalf of the entire NewsHour team, thank you for joining us.